and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio, and thank you for joining us on this very special episode. We are in Madrid today covering the 25th anniversary event for Lit, and I am very happy to have with me Carlos Gorgiguez-Pagón. How are you today, Carlos?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thanks for taking the time to join us today. It's a very busy schedule at the event, so
thanks, we really appreciate it.
And of course, if you would like to know more about the event before we start, in the description below there will be links so you can find out more about Carlos, more about the event, what we're talking about today, and everything that's related. But today we're going to be talking on the theme of technology. What do we do with it? How do we integrate it? And my first question for you, Carlos, is do you think that technology and, in fact, liberalism are linked? If so, in what way and how?
I've always thought that that was true. Technology is a driving force towards liberty. I had a friend some years ago who said that the fall of the Berlin Wall was, at the end of the day, not due to the military efforts of the United States. It had to do with television. It had to do with the idea that people in the communist countries suddenly started to watch the TV and to see how the world was beyond the wall, how the world of capitalism was. And perhaps that is too far-fetched, but I'm sure it had something to do. Technology communicates people and enlarges our knowledge. And it's difficult to have a despotic government for many years if people are suddenly able to know what's going on. But let's see, in the case of China, they are since 1949. So I think politically it's a force for liberty, and economically it's a driving force for prosperity.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we're on this topic, what do you think governments or officials, people in charge, should do to promote free access of technology? Should it be something that should be given out, or should it be, you know, paid for? Or what is your opinion on it?
I'm always worried about or suspicious about government, because independent of their intentions, frequently are very good ones. The results are often not very good. And in the specific case of technology, I think governments are starting to intervene perhaps too fast, too quickly, and too deeply. And that perhaps can put a sort of a break in the technological progress, which I think it's a negative example. So in the 19th century, people would say, leave us alone.
Right.
and in the 18th century, the French would say, laissez faire, no? Laissez passer, le monde va de lui-même. No? I don't want to look as an anarcho-capitalist, but I think that if there is one message that one should give to the authorities is beware. Beware not to throw the baby with the water, and to keep all the good things that technology has.
Yeah, and it is a very fascinating topic of discussion when it comes to technology, because when it comes to spreading news, spreading information, it is now happening faster than any other time in history. And it's very much on demand. People want it immediately. They want it now. They want it quick. Mm-hmm. And I think we've never been in such a time. So that raises the question of how do we adapt all of this new technology to the potential ethical threats? How do we maintain the truth there? And how do we make sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands?
There's always a risk in technological progress. When you didn't have the printing press, you had very few books. the great Italian historian Carlo Cipolla wrote that in the Middle Ages, a rich family, a rich one, perhaps could have a dozen books, and no, not more than that. Okay, what did the printing press do? What technology always does, it reduces costs. It permits you to do the same thing you did before, but very much quicker and very much cheaper. Do I mean by that that it is just paradise? Of course it is not. Because when you started to be able to print all kinds of books very quickly and very cheaply, you also were able to print very bad books.
Right.
And to print lies, and yes, to print all kinds of things. It's the same with technological progress today. I mean, we have an impressive amount of information now that is cheap. By the way, it should not be given away free, that, to answer a question you were asking before.
Yeah.
But you do have a huge amount of information, and a certain percentage of it is not true. It is false. It's fake news or whatever you would like to
name. It's a big topic of discussion, yeah, what is true. Yeah.
That's right. But the point is, when you have that, what should you do? I mean, if you have the risk that people would be, let's say, intoxicated with fake news, what should you do? I mean, should we establish a ministry of the truth?
Well, I surely hope we don't.
I hope we don't.
No.
But that is one idea politicians are very prone to have. I mean, if we have a problem, let's establish a bureaucracy.
Well, it is happening. I mean, to current events, it is something that is being discussed within the EU circles at the moment, the taxation of news links, which is a current proposal, an article which is in the works, and that does very much threaten the way news and links can be distributed, mm-hmm, and then in the same way audited and taxed and everything to go with it, which does exactly put this question into order. I mean, mm-hmm, is it even real? Should you monetize it? Should it be accessible to everyone? And that's something I think that with the rise of the internet, we haven't really thought about so far.
Yes, and I think we have not thought also of one thing. Is that, I mean, when you have technological progress, you disrupt things. You disrupt businesses. I mean,
yes,
if you were the owner of the Wells Fargo stagecoach company,
right,
and suddenly railways began to run, you were in a hell of a problem. Okay,
no.
The point is, what is to be done in that case? Should railways be paralyzed or be taxed or be forbidden? I mean, that's why I was saying beware, because technology causes fear. We have sort of a double sentiment on progress. We like progress, but we are afraid
like
of change.
Exactly, yeah.
And so we are surrounded by fears. Let me tell you one very famous one. The negative relation between technology and employment.
Yes.
The idea that now robots will take away our jobs. And when you see, you have the first impression, your first conclusion is, it must be true. I mean, if I do a job and suddenly 3PO or whatever the name of the robot is, will do the same job as I did, I'm out of my employment. So that is one subject I will touch today in my speak. Because I will have the opportunity of speaking well of economists, and that's very good news.
Yeah.
Very, very good news. Why? Because a particularly brilliant English economist 200 years ago, his name was Ricardo, David Ricardo, was the first one who analyzed critically the idea that technology conspires against the workers, depriving them for employment. And he had the wonderful intuition to say that what at first sight seems true, when you take the whole picture, it is not true. And technology is not an enemy of the working classes, because what technology does for the economy is to increase productivity. And if you increase productivity, you increase economic growth. And if you increase economic growth, you increase employment in the end.
And standard and quality of life as well.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's fantastic insight there. And thank you very much for joining us on the podcast to discuss all of this. And of course, for our listeners, if you enjoyed our conversation today, please check out the links in the description below where you can find out more about the event. Of course, the speaking that Carlos will be undertaking, and all of the relevant links as well to do with our event and, of course, Lit Publishing. Once again, thank you very much, Carlos, for joining us.
Thanks to you.
Pleasure. And we look forward to seeing you next week. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. And thank you for joining us on this special episode as we're recording straight from Madrid. And with me is author Sally Bibb. As you might know, she is a previous guest on a podcast. How are you today, Sally?
Very well, thank you.
It's good to have you back on the podcast. And let's get straight into today's topic.
Great.
Because we know you have a very busy schedule and we're very happy for you to take the time to join us. And the first question I have for you, in your opinion, what has been the biggest challenge facing organizations when it comes to being future-proof?
A number of challenges, I think. The top ones for me are being able to stay current and doing what the customers want them to do. And we all know examples of organizations that haven't stayed with the times or ahead of the times, and others such as Uber, Amazon, you know, many organizations have suffered because their strategy has been rooted really in past beliefs. And the second one is being able to get really good people and keep them.
Yeah, and that's always the topic of discussion, retaining the talent.
That's right.
And going on from that, how can actually companies thrive and engage with their workforce more effectively, and perhaps more importantly, as we just said, retain them in the long run, not just in the short term?
I think, you know, a good tip would be to think about your people that work for your employees in the same way you think about your customers. Understand what they care about. Understand their values, their motivations, how they want to grow. And so it becomes more of an equal relationship. You know, in the old days, the organization, the employer had the power and the person was in service to them. And I think it's much more of a two-way street now.
Yeah, absolutely. You're judging the employer as they're judging you in a way during the interview. That's
absolutely right.
That's something that most people don't really get when they go for interviews. But going on from that, let's talk a bit about strengths. And of course, for those listening, go back and listen to our podcast about the strengths book to find out more on that. But what role do strengths play when it comes to trying to realize your employees' potential? How do we build on them?
So what we know is that you don't achieve great performance by trying to fix your weaknesses. You know, sports people know that, and what they do is they polish their strengths, they stretch themselves in the direction of their strengths. That's not to say ignore weaknesses that matter, but if you put most of your focus on the things that you're naturally good at, that energize you and that you love doing, that's where you're going to get great potential. And that's true of organizations as it is for individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, with that, it's been a great preview of what we're talking about today. And of course, for those listening, Sally will be speaking at our event here in Madrid. And in the links in the description below, you can find out every information about that. And of course, her follow-up from this short preview podcast, which we're very happy that she took the time to come and join us. So thank you very much, Sally. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Muchas gracias.
For our audience, you can always reach out to us on social media and then let us know what you think about today's event and the conversation. We always look forward to hearing from you. Hi, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and I will be your host for today's show. As you know, we are covering our very special event today in Madrid. We've come all the way from London, and we have a very special guest joining us next on the podcast, and it is Pedro Nueno. How are you today, Pedro?
Well, thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, and we're very happy that you've taken some time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. But without further ado, we really wanted to talk to you about the educational challenges and, of course, the economy of the future today, which has been a very big presence in this event and, of course, in everyone's lives. So perhaps can you tell us what are the educational challenges and the economy of the future that we face?
Well, I think that the economy is making progress all over the world, and education must do also a progress all over the world. There are areas where the economy is growing a lot, like it is the case of China, for instance, and they come from poverty, and education is not something that you can generate from today to tomorrow. So to establish a very good education is a complex process. It's like it's closer to healthcare, for instance, where you need doctors, and doctors cannot be created just overnight. So in education, you need good professors, you need facilities, you need good administrators, you need a budget for all of these things. Sometimes people are not prepared to pay all the cost of very good education, so it needs some support. This support can come from the government, but they can. It can also come from the corporate social responsibility of companies that identify that this is a need, that this is good, that is better to help with this thing, because we create a better society, but we create a better market also. So I think that the big problem is that for the nature of education is not an easy thing to build. So it requires lots of resources and a good strategy and commitment. Society wants education in all over the world, but sometimes there is not the adequate organization to bring this to reality.
Absolutely. And that leads me into the next question, and that is, as a matter of fact, our current educational system. What do you think we will need to change to get to the point where we make this progress happen?
Well, again, I think that we need a bigger volume. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I will mention in my speech is that we are using a lot of selectivity to accept students into different schools, higher schools, graduate schools, and the selectivity is only a way to say, okay, we can get 100, we have 300 applicants, so let's organize some kind of test and take the 100 that get a better result in the test. Are we sure that these 100 are the 100 that have more potential of these 300?
Right.
I'm absolutely convinced that no. That all the selectivity and the selectivity systems we have today are not adequate. This year, for the first time, I've seen the press criticizing all over the world the selectivity in the past weeks, because it's now when this is taking place. And I fully agree with this. I think that we need to improve the way to select people, but most importantly, we need to increase the amount of education available.
Absolutely, great insight there. And of course, a large portion of our audience is within the millennial age range, or perhaps people going into higher education or into education at all. Can you perhaps tell them one piece of advice as they go on their educational pathways to the future?
Well, I think that one important thing is to accept that this is a priority, and give the adequate position in the different, let's say, things that we need. We need lots of things, clearly. We need infrastructures, we need health, improve the health system. We have to include education as a priority and make sure that this is available for everybody. So in some cases, a wealthy family can pay for an excellent education for their children, and you have some children with tremendous capacity, willingness, but their family cannot pay for a reasonable education. So this is very, very unfair.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, thank you very much for joining us today, Pedro. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And of course, for our listeners, links in the description below where you can find out more information about today's event.
Okay.
Everyone, thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's Lit Radio podcast on this very special occasion as we are recording in Madrid from our 25th anniversary event. And with me today is a returning guest of the podcast. It is Giles Lurie. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Enjoying the lovely weather over here in Spain.
Yeah, much better than what we're having at the moment in the UK with all the humidity.
Yeah, that's right. I think the absolute sunshine is always fantastic. It brings out the best in people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, thanks for taking the time to join us on the podcast today. It is a very busy schedule as, you know, we have all sorts of authors, speakers, you know, gathered here today in this, I guess, event of knowledge and sharing. But again, thank you very much. And let's get into the quick conversation that we have lined up for today. And we're talking about the modern brand and, of course, the complexities behind one. And my first question for you, Giles, is what are the key ingredients to a modern brand in today's ever-changing work environment?
Can I say, first of all, thank you for the way you phrased the question. What is so interesting is how many people would have phrased that, what's the one thing that a new brand needs to do nowadays? And you said key ingredients.
Just one thing. It has to be one, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting is the fact that we try and simplify things down. So you asked the question in a way that was encouraging me to think about more than one thing, and I'd have to say I'm delighted to do that because I do think it takes more than one. Having done some work and having talked recently to sort of like a group of about 25 different marketing directors, I tried to get them to talk about what they thought were the key elements. First of all, one of the things that really comes through is having a clarity of purpose. What does your brand stand for? What does it believe in? What would it campaign for? To understand that, and that might be quite a big concept, not just something like, you know, washing whiter. Actually, it is broader than that. Probably the second one that a lot of people will talk about and might surprise people is a strong culture. Actually, the best brands come from within. And there's a lot of talk about being consumer-centric and customer-centric. But there's a very famous quote from Richard Branson that says, actually, I don't put customers first, I put my staff first. Because if my staff are happy, then they'll look after my customers and my customers will be happy. And overall, we'll all benefit. The third one is we live in a changing world. Boy, is it changing, and it's changing ever more rapidly in terms of that. So an ability to keep innovating, to keep changing. And I talk quite a lot often about preserving the core whilst stimulating change. Staying true to that purpose, but changing along the way. The other one is, I think, while we like things, increasingly people like experiences. And delivering a distinctive customer experience. If you went to a party hosted by a brand, could you tell me what that party was like? And if you can, actually it's quite likely that you've got something with your brand.
Right.
And finally, not surprisingly, I think you have to be a master of complexity. You have to learn how to manage the multiplicity that's out there and not shy away from the chaotic world that's out there. But actually learn how to control it and manage it to your benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's build on that because there is this idea going around and it's in all facets and, you know, parts of business about simplicity, how you should embrace simplicity and everything should be simple and, you know, caveman with rock and that kind of thing. But as a matter of fact, brands need to be able to embrace the complex side of things as well because sometimes things are not as simple as they seem. Why do they need to embrace this complexity?
I think things have changed. If you press the rewind button and went back 50 years, there were brands that were one brand, one product, one target audience, and it was very much a sell model. But things have fundamentally changed. No longer are brands just one product. If you think about any sort of product, whether it's Dove, which used to just be a soap bar and is now available in a range of products for women, for older women, for men. There's talk of Dove Baby. There are a huge range of products.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember when you would buy a Dove soap and it would be your soap, your shampoo, your dishwasher, your motor grease, your car wash. You know, it's all in one. But now it's that's changing.
What that also brings with it is it means that you get a whole range of different target audiences. So you have to talk to different people and actually talking to them at the same time. So the idea of just a single message just doesn't work anymore because I've got to talk to my classic soap buyer. I've got to talk to my older woman who's considering about what she looks like and how she wants to celebrate her beauty. I've got to talk to men. I've got to talk to my staff. I've got to talk to the trade who I want to stock the brand. Actually, brands have to manage all of those elements. And there are more channels now than ever there were. You were talking about how Lid Radio is now having to go into so many more different channels in terms of where that is. Actually, that's true of brands as well. And there is a danger that in a chaotic world, what has come to happen is the danger of simplifying. Now, simplifying in itself is not bad. It's probably a good thing. But the quote that I often use is the Einstein quote, which is to make things as simple as possible, but not any simpler. And that idea of that bit at the end of saying, in a complex world, I want it to be simple if I can, but I don't want to oversimplify it. The analogy, in fact, I was just talking to one of the attendees here and we were talking about it, and she said she was a scientist, and I said, yeah, quantum physics isn't simple, nor is human behaviour, and marketing is based on human behaviour. So the danger of oversimplifying is a real danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And following on, can you perhaps give us an example of a brand that's currently applying this level of execution?
I think perhaps there are a number of brands that have moved to this one. One that I think is often quoted, but is a really interesting one, would be Virgin. Virgin is a really interesting one. Virgin spans all sorts of different areas of where it is and actually has an overarching purpose of being the consumer champion. Richard Branson talks about standing up for the little guy. He talks about wanting to, whatever he does, to bring benefits to the people he's doing it. And to do it in a certain way. So if I went to a Virgin party, I'd sort of know what to expect. But that means that he can then now do banking, he can do travel, he can do music, he can do entertainment, he's done radio, all of those sorts of things. And what is interesting about that is he has a core philosophy and a core way of doing business that based on some principles, but then he understands the different needs that he has to do across all of the different business ones. So it's a lovely example of how that's being worked.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Great insight there, Giles. And of course, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed our brief conversation, of course, in the description link below, you can find out all the available information about today's event. Of course, more about the topic of complexity and simplifying and brands, of course, as Giles was one of the speakers at our event here today. And of course, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on this special episode of the podcast. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. And if you'd like to reach out to us with some feedback, it's always great to hear from our audience. Find us on those social media channels at Lit Radio. So once again, thank you very much, Giles, for joining us.
Thank you very much.